lots of times as a counselor, I hear that we should not be introspective, and I'm criticized for helping people do just that. And I have to agree with them sometimes that introspection is bad if it only leaves me with some understanding of myself that drops on dead ground. But introspection is really good if it leads me to greater self-knowledge and then to an understanding of how to love myself, other people, and God.
Welcome to Christianity at Work, a radio ministry of Mackenzie Study Center. Our hosts are Dr. Jack Crabtree and Christine Barber. Jack is a philosopher by training, but his real passion is the Bible, having studied and taught it for more than 25 years. He is currently on staff at Mackenzie Study Center and Gutenberg College in Eugene, Oregon. Christine is a licensed marriage and family therapist, having practiced in California and Oregon for over 20 years. She is employed by the Caris Foundation, a teaching and counseling ministry. In this series, titled Being a Christian, Jack and Christine discuss the most important biblical concepts of the Christian life. Now, here are Jack and Christine.
Jack, I remember in about second or third grade, I was a kid that wasn't very well accepted by the other kids, and I really wanted to be. So I remember looking at one girl, her name was Wendy, and decided that if I watched how she acted, that maybe I could be popular like her. So I remember one day, really clearly in my mind, watching her do the Pledge of Allegiance. We used to do that every morning before school. Remember that?
Yeah, back in the old days.
The very old days. And she was doing the Pledge of Allegiance. I remember how she placed her hand over her heart. I remember how she looked at the flag. I remember the expression on her face. And it was like, if I could do that, then maybe other people would like me. Well, that was a little second grader's mind. But I don't think sometimes I went too much further than that, like when I was in college, because I asked myself the question, not what would it look like to be popular, but what would it look like to be a spiritual woman? There was a lot of books out at that time, like The Total Woman or Women Who Pray, and just a lot about women and their spirituality. And I remember thinking that those kind of women were a lot softer than myself. They didn't talk quite as much. They were very submissive. They had kind of glowing eyes, and they just talked about loving Jesus. And, you know, I really tried to kind of be that kind of person, but as you know, I'm not really soft and submissive. I'm kind of feisty. But I think what I've come to the conclusion is that spirituality certainly doesn't look any particular way. But I think that a spiritual person always is a courageous person. What do you think?
Yeah, that's true. The courage to, ultimately I like to describe it as the courage to follow truth wherever, whatever it is and wherever it leads. And that has to translate into the courage in the face of opposition from other people, scorn from other people, the disrespect of other people. So they're just day after day opportunities to exercise courage. Yeah.
I know that in my life, I'm often not courageous. And I often have to look back and say, oh, look back there. I didn't do it right. I hope that I do it better the next time. But it's kind of an ongoing process of noticing where I wasn't courageous and having to kind of recalibrate and go ahead again and try to make a better decision next time. Before we get into that, though, can we talk about the time when Peter was really courageous in Acts?
Mm-hmm. The one passage in particular that's really striking to me is the account of Peter being called to go and proclaim the gospel to Cornelius. As the story goes, Peter has ended up in a little village called Joppa. Well, actually, not a little village. It's a small town called Joppa. That's a couple of days' journey south of Caesarea. Caesarea was the seaport for Jerusalem on the Mediterranean coast and was largely a Roman city. And there was stationed, I don't know what it would be called, a battalion or a cohort of Roman soldiers in Caesarea. And they had a centurion over one of the, whatever centurions are over, that part of the Roman army that their commander's over. And this particular centurion, his name is Cornelius, was a, what they call a God-fearer. And God-fearers were Gentiles during this time who were morally and spiritually and intellectually hip enough to recognize that the bankruptcy, the moral and spiritual bankruptcy of the Roman culture, the worship of the polytheistic pantheon was a loser, their mystery religions were worthless, and they were looking for something with any kind of moral and spiritual substance. They had brushed up against Judaism, had become really intrigued by it, so much so that they'd really become thoroughgoing students of Judaism, and were, for the most part, practitioners. They hadn't proselytized. They hadn't actually become Jews. Historians speculate why not. Some of them argue that circumcision was a pretty daunting step and that they just weren't willing to do that. I don't know. I don't know the answer to why they didn't actually just convert to Judaism. Maybe it would have cost them too much culturally. But they would go to synagogue, and as Gentile observers sit on the outside and listen to the scriptures read and expounded and take part in the life of the synagogue. And they might as well have been Jews from the standpoint of their knowledge and understanding of the Old Testament and the faith of the Jews. Well, Cornelius was one of these people. He was a God-fearer. So Peter is staying with a man named Simon in Joppa, and he gets a vision.
Okay, let me hold you up for a minute. A lot of people might know about this, but I'm going to review a little bit. So Peter is a Jew, and Cornelius is a Gentile.
Right.
And a Gentile really just means generally not a Jew.
Not a Jew, right.
Okay. And they were very different classes of people in that time.
Right.
Right? And it would have been pretty amazing that Cornelius even would have sat outside the Jewish temple, as I understand how their cultures didn't really work together well, and listened to what was going on there. It was quite a big step to do that.
Yes, the Gentiles were outcasts. They did make provision for them to be able to be observers to the synagogue, but they were not full participants in it because they kept themselves socially isolated from one another, because from the Jews' point of view, as they had understood their religion and as that had been interpreted through their tradition, it was not lawful for them to associate with one another. So there basically was no social interaction between the two.
So it was not lawful. It was wrong according to their Jewish religion.
Tradition, at least, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and they really believed it.
Absolutely.
They kept themselves very, very separate.
And so it was not just, I think it would be easy to, in our day and age, especially in our climate, to kind of misinterpret the aloofness of the Jews as some kind of, you know, racism or ethnocentrism or something like that. I mean, that's what we're sensitive to these days.
Certainly that's what would come to mind.
Right.
You just outcast a group and that's wrong.
Right. But we don't really understand where they're coming from until we recognize that from their perspective, they are the people of God. God has given them the law and instructed them in how to live holy lives, and their lives are committed to pursuing that holiness. The Gentiles are not instructed in holiness, do not have any promise or any covenant with God. They are unclean, and by unclean, they mean they are immoral. They're unrighteous. They're ungodly people following an evil agenda in their lives. And so the separation is for the sake of their own moral and spiritual and religious purity. It's for the sake of their soul. It's for the sake of their faithfulness to their heritage, which is a covenant with God. So they do it as an act of moral principle, not as some kind of just short-sighted, ignorant bigotry.
For them, it was the ultimate right for the Jews.
Exactly, exactly. And I probably should add, it's easy for us as Christians to look back on them and say, well, yeah, I mean, that's what they thought. That was their tradition. That was their interpretation of the law. But, boy, they were sure blind, because the Old Testament is telling us about Jesus and is telling us that the Abraham's blessing, the blessing of Abraham is for the Gentiles as well as the Jews. They had just totally perverted and distorted what the Old Testament is saying. It's easy to say that because we Gentile Christians today, I think, are not as well read in the Old Testament as we think that we are. That if we go back and look at the Old Testament and just look at it in its own right, without importing the New Testament into it all the time, if we just look at the Old Testament in its own right, there are some elements to it that are really kind of cryptic and are really kind of hard to put together, and it's very understandable, very reasonable for the Jews to have reached the sorts of conclusions that they reached based on the evidence that they had, the Old Testament scriptures.
Jeff, I'm going to have to hold you up a minute.
Okay.
I don't know what cryptic means.
Hidden, you know, kind of hidden and like a puzzle, like a riddle it's very difficult to know. You don't have all the pieces, so you can't really put it together.
Okay.
And so the real meaning is hidden from you.
It's hard to figure out.
Yeah. So what we fail to remember is that Jesus is portrayed as the last prophet. Jesus was the one who came along and revealed even more than the prophets had revealed before him. And it's kind of like the last pieces to the puzzle, the pieces that you need in order to see how everything else fits together. So we, knowing what Jesus came to say, we can go back to the Old Testament and we can see clearly what God was up to all along, from beginning with Abraham on, that yes, this was ultimately about Jews and Gentiles alike. But that's because we have the last piece that we can see that.
So we can interpret it through all that Jesus said, and it makes right. it far more easy for us than it was for them.
Exactly.
They really didn't have enough to put it all together.
Right. So we're in no position to scold them, because had we been in the same position, we would have had just as much difficulty getting it right as they did. I think they got it wrong, but it's understandable that they got it wrong. And it was not out of any sort of evil and rebellious and maliciousness necessarily. They just needed some more information, and when they finally got it, when Jesus came along, many of them believed.
Okay, so you said that because it really does make sense that these people, these Jews, would think the Gentiles were really people that they shouldn't associate with.
Right.
Given the information they had, it made sense to them. It wasn't a simple matter for them at all to understand.
Right. Okay, so, I mean, my simple point is we make a mistake to just see them as bigots here. This is morally and spiritually motivated. But nevertheless, it was unlawful for someone like Peter, for a man like Peter, to even associate with a Gentile. So Peter is up on the roof of his home in Joppa, of the place where he's staying in Joppa, about noontime, and he gets a vision from God. And the vision is of a sheet being lowered down from heaven with all kinds of animals in the sheet that are basically ruled unclean by the Mosaic Law. These are animals that they were forbidden to eat the meat of. I mean, the famous one, of course, is the pig. I mean, there were others besides, but Jews don't eat ham because that's forbidden to eat the meat of a pig. So there was probably a pig and some other animals in the sheet that's lowered down. And then this voice, the voice of God, comes to Peter and says, "Take, kill, and eat." And Peter responds to this voice of God saying, "But Lord, I have never eaten anything unclean in my entire life." And the voice repeats itself, "Take, kill, and eat." And that happens three times, where the voice invites him to eat, and Peter says, I assume the way to read it is, Peter responds each time, but I've never eaten anything unclean my entire life.
So he's really blown away by this. It's like, what, are you kidding? I'm trying to think of something that would happen to me, and I would just have to say, oh man, no way. It's kind of like when Abraham was told to bring Isaac up and sacrifice him.
Right.
That would have been about as big for him. No, I'm really trying to do what's right. How can I possibly kill my son? Would be obviously Abraham's response. And I think it's easier for us to see that. Of course I wouldn't kill my son. No, no, no. But would you say it's about that strength for Peter?
Yes, I think so. Abraham's is a little bit more complicated and has other dimensions to it. But if we're just measuring the
The psychological impact.
Yeah, the psychological resistance, I think it would be very comparable. Exactly. You know, from in my past, everyone will have their own story in this regard, but there was a time where, for me, drinking alcohol was just absolutely and completely an evil thing. And nobody could make any claim to authentic, credible spirituality whoever let any alcohol into their system. I was mentioning the other day in a sermon I was giving about, I had a nightmare that I don't remember my dreams very well, but there are only two nightmares in my entire life that I remember, and one of them I had on more than one occasion. I'm running down the street, and there's a group of street thugs who are running after me, and they catch me, and they pin down my arms and my legs, and one of them pries open my mouth, and another one comes along with an eyedropper, and it's got alcohol in it, and he drops this eyedropper, and a drop of alcohol touches my tongue. I have this sense of defilement that starts at my head and goes down my whole body, and then I wake up.
Oh, man, Jack, we're going to have to start over and fix you.
But that's just how ingrained it had become.
Yeah.
What a defiling, evil thing alcohol was. Mm-hmm. So.
And you believed it with everything in your body, conscious and unconscious. You even dreamed about it.
Exactly, yeah. I mean, it was just.
This is the kind of dream that Peter might have had he considered the possibility of eating pig.
Exactly. So it would be like me having a vision during that time of God lowering a number of six-packs down on a sheet and telling me to drink up. I mean, that's how it would have had an impact on Peter, I think.
It would have been absolutely overturning to you, overwhelming to you, undoable to you.
Exactly.
And so it makes sense that God had to put that down three times, and Peter keeps saying, no way.
Mm-hmm. The question, as I was studying that passage, the question that came to mind is, well, as you go on in the story, I guess I better give that piece first. As you go on in the story, the next thing that happens in the story is that two servants and a military attendant of the centurion arrive just outside the house, and they start inquiring after Simon Peter, the apostle.
And okay, so these people would have been Gentiles.
And they're Gentiles.
That were going to a Jewish home.
Right. So these Gentiles show up. So Peter then puts two and two together and recognizes immediately somehow that the vision is related to the appearance of these men. So on the basis of the vision, he invites them in and asks them what they want. Now, inviting them in to start with, as best I can tell, would have been unlawful in its own right. So immediately he has the courage to do what all of his life he has deemed to be unlawful, but what he now recognizes God is asking him to do. And he does what God is asking him to do, even though probably every fiber of his being is saying, Peter, you unclean idiot, what are you doing? You weak.
I think the word bad comes bad, to mind.
Okay.
To me.
You bad.
You are
boy.
Bad and you are wrong.
Right.
How can you possibly do this? It would have been screaming in his head.
Exactly. But he has the courage to do what he has understood God to be asking him to do. And then he proceeds to not only invite them in, inquire what they want. They say Cornelius sent them. He follows them, accompanies them, travels back to Caesarea with them. He enters the house of Cornelius, clearly an unlawful thing to do. The first thing he says to Cornelius is, on the following day he entered Caesarea. Now Cornelius was waiting for them and had called together his relatives and close friends. So the place is packed with Gentiles. When Peter entered, Cornelius met him and fell at his feet and worshipped him. But Peter raised him up, saying, stand up, I too am just a man. As he talked with him, he entered and found many people assembled, and he said to them, you yourselves know how unlawful it is for a man who is a Jew to associate with a foreigner, a Gentile, or to visit him. And yet God has shown me that I should not call any man unholy or unclean. So based on the instruction of God, he had the courage to resist all those voices that had to be screaming in his head, all those scruples against associating with Gentiles. He was going to do what God had instructed him to do rather than what his own visceral response told him was appropriate.
his own visceral response, his own feeling, emotional response, said, absolutely no, you shouldn't. But there's also other things, and that's that the other Jews that were looking on, other friends who had respected him, he is having the courage to possibly lose their respect.
Absolutely.
Maybe even be kicked out of the Jewish community. I don't know.
That's very real. As the account goes on, you get to the next chapter. Chapter 11 starts, "Now the apostles and the brethren who were throughout Judea heard that the Gentiles also had received the word of God. And when Peter came up to Jerusalem, those who were circumcised took issue with him, saying, 'You went to uncircumcised men and ate with them.'"
Okay, so circumcised, uncircumcised. Circumcised are the people that are Jews. Uncircumcised are the Gentiles. So the Jews went up to the Jew Peter and said, "Hey, you really did a bad thing. You really did a wrong thing. What do you mean associating with those bad people?"
Yeah.
Those really bad people that are unclean.
So he's created a real controversy. He has become the focal point of serious criticism in Jerusalem for what he did.
So what we started with is looking at somebody who is courageous, and certainly Peter was courageous in a very bold and visual way, not just inside his own heart, though that's very significant, but also in terms of how other people would perceive him, really going out on a limb to do what God wanted him to do what he thought was right.
Right, exactly. Now, the thing that's curious about that account to me, as I was looking at that account, is the way God teaches Peter, because it's very odd when you think about it. The message that Peter actually successfully got was, as he puts it, that no man is unholy or unclean, that I should not call any man unholy or unclean. That's what he learned. That's what God had shown him. Well, how did he show him? By asking him to eat food that wasn't kosher. Well, why? What's the connection? That it's not apparent that I would get a vision about eating unkosher food and immediately jump to the conclusion that I could associate with Gentiles. It's one thing to eat other food. It's another thing to associate with Gentiles. What's the connection? I think the reason that the thing that makes the most sense to me is that God is taking something that is not quite so radical for Peter, something that Peter at least intellectually recognizes as true, and using that by analogy to stretch him to believe something and see something and know something that is a real stretch for him.
So the lesser stretch was to eat food that he always has thought was unclean.
Right.
An even larger stretch would be to go associate with these non-Jewish people.
Right. And the reason I say that is because if you look through the Gospels, there are accounts in the Gospels where Jesus himself taught his disciples that the dietary regulations were somehow not really to the heart of the matter. In fact, in the Gospel of Mark, Jesus makes this comment that's recorded in several Gospels in Mark, which many people believe is really based on the teaching of Peter, that Mark was a colleague of Peter for a while, and he's basically recounting and putting together his gospel from the standpoint of Peter's understanding and Peter's teaching. And Mark's parenthetical comment after this is, "And thus Jesus taught that all foods were clean." Well, that teaching Peter has already received before this account has occurred. This is while Jesus was still on the earth and he was hanging out with Jesus and learning from him. He had been taught by Jesus that all foods were clean. Now, Peter says here, though, in this account, that he has never eaten anything unclean. And I take that at face value. I think that's probably true. And I can relate to that, because it's one thing to come to a conviction that something is actually morally permissible. It's another thing to actually make it a part of your life.
Is that true for you with the alcohol?
Yeah. To this day, I'm really not an alcohol drinker. Even though now, unlike then, I'm thoroughly convinced that it's not in and of itself a moral issue. But it's just not something I want to do, and I never have. And, you know, it's not that in the right sort of set of circumstances, if I thought it was important in my relationship with someone, that I might have a few sips just to forge a connection. I feel free to do that, but it's not anything that I would ever seek out or want to do or ever do for myself. I just don't. It's not a part of my life. And that's where I could see Peter. okay, he learned from his master, his rabbi, that really eating kosher is not the most important thing. It's what comes out of your heart, Jesus says, that defiles a man, not what goes into your stomach. Peter knew that in his head. So now God is coming and taking that piece of information that has been successfully
implanted
in Peter's brain and saying, okay, Peter, act on that in this vision. Eat, take, and eat. Oh, no, I have never done that. No, take and eat. And then it must be the coincidence with the men showing up and the vision just having occurred, I mean, just moments before, that Peter somehow puts two and two together and recognizes this wasn't about eating kosher. This was about what I'm supposed to do with these unclean men here. Now, how exactly he immediately could put that together, I don't know, but it makes sense. I mean, the other thing that's curious is why a vision like this rather than just the Spirit of God telling Peter, Peter, no man is unclean? I mean, why such a dramatic kind of thing? And again, I think the answer is because to just tell him wouldn't have got him any further than he already was. He already was at a point where intellectually, as a part of his theology, he was prepared to be a little bit more radical than his Jewish contemporaries. He was willing to call all foods clean, for example, I think. And maybe he'd be prepared to say that Gentiles are not inherently or intrinsically unclean. It's one thing to know that. It's another thing to be prepared to have the courage to go against all of your scruples and act on it. Act as if they're not unclean. Treat them as if they're not unclean. Interact with them and associate with them as if they're not unclean. So I think the vision is for the purpose of kind of getting in Peter's face and saying, Peter, it's time to act now. Peter, you've got to choose. Peter, this has to be more than in your head now. You're going to have to embrace it with your entire being and be willing to act on it.
And, you know, he really did, because, you know, he actually went to Caesarea and went into the Gentiles' home. Mm-hmm. But notice what he did when he went into the Gentiles' home. They bowed down, and does it say they started kissing his feet?
Well, worshipped him, which is to put your head to the floor. And
okay, so even in private, he could have been proud. He could have said, well, I walked into this home, and, you know, that's big enough. You know, I did this, God. Okay, here it is. But it seems like his whole heart was into it. He was really drawn into what God had asked him to do. Mm-hmm. He was given over to it, because when they kind of bow down, he says to them, wait a minute, I'm a man just like you. So what he had come to believe in his heart, and not just with his actions, was we're not different from each other. Wow, what an amazing thing. It's like, you know, earlier in the century when the blacks and whites were having so many problems, well, the whites finally let the blacks, you know, ride on their buses or drink out of their drinking fountains, but they never let them. Or it just seemed like when I watch things or read things about that time, they didn't consider the blacks and the whites to be like each other. They were just kind of begrudgingly allowing things because it was lawful. And it seems like Peter went way beyond that.
Right,
his
right.
heart was transformed into somebody who was recognizing, I am like you. What an incredible statement. It's just such a measure of his spirituality. And, you know, of his obedience,
his self-knowledge, his self-understanding.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Excellent point. Yeah, because these were Gentile dogs to the Jewish culture. And for him to say, I am like you, is to say, look, none of us are worthy of God. I mean, to have really got a very clear perspective on the unworthiness of a human being before his creator.
And that we all hold that in common.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And he wasn't different anymore. I just think that is the most incredible thing, and just a transformation of somebody's heart. And it seems to me, Jack, that we have a lot of courage that comes out of that. If we can come to an understanding of who we really are, which is it humbles us, it kind of cuts us to the core, then we don't have any place anymore to think that we're different than other people or to hold them in contempt. We are like them.
Yeah, exactly.
What I'd like to do now, Jack, is take this section of Scripture and try and see how it looks in our lives today. when you were teaching this passage, and I thought you did such an excellent job, that's why I wanted to talk about it today. You talked about having a visceral response, as Peter did, to something that's being presented to us. We have this response, and we'll either go toward looking at the issues, or maybe we'll just take this response that we have and just back off and not want it to be a part of our lives. What Peter did was try and push it away three times. No, God, I really can't do that. No, God, I really can't do that. But he finally listened to it, and he paid attention to it enough that he recognized, as we just said, that he was just like a Gentile, went into their homes and was willing to put up with the whole backlash that came later. I would say that that was an incredible shift in his perception of himself, his perception of who God was, his perception of his own religion. Mm-hmm. It seems like when those kind of possibilities come up for us where we might have to shift a whole lot of what we believe, that it takes a lot of courage to continue to think in that direction.
Right. We, through our religious training, through our spiritual training, through our culture, we have ingrained in us all kinds of scruples, hesitations that are very visceral or emotional, very powerful feelings that arise in us in response to different situations. If something seems wrong, seems unclean, seems bad to us, that we have a very, almost physical response to it at times. I think that's a God-given response and a very healthy response and a good response. The problem we have is we tend to take the response itself as truth. Whereas God did not intend it as truth, he intended it rather as a big warning sign to welcome us, invite us into the process of thinking critically about this thing that we have confronted before we proceed. In the message that you're referring to, I likened it to the little dialogue box that I get on my computer when I give it the command to erase a disk. And it puts this little dialogue box on my screen that says, "Are you sure you want to erase this disk?" And, being the kind of person I am, I always feel guilty when I erase the disk because, it's telling me it's a bad thing to do. Are you sure you want
to do this?
Better
not do that.
It's like
you're a pretty obedient guy.
It's my cyber conscience there.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, the way I respond to that dialogue box is, especially early in my Christian life, oftentimes the way I would respond to these emotions. That these emotions that were telling me something was bad were simply infallibly telling me the truth. If I feel that it's bad, I can't go there. That has to be exactly what Peter is experiencing here. All kinds of feelings, powerful feelings saying, "Peter, this is bad," and yet he goes there anyway. What's the difference? Peter is not crediting those feelings as having any more value than in fact they have. Their true value is to be this warning sign telling him, before you proceed, know what you're doing. Discern what's right, what's wrong, pursue what's right, and continue to resist what's wrong. But don't just feel that something is wrong. Analyze this now. Resolve in your own heart, resolve in your own mind before God, what's the truth here? What's valuable, what's not, what's right, what's wrong, what's good, what's evil? So probably all of us as believers have come up across those times in our life where in order to make progress in wisdom, in order to grow in my understanding and my maturity and my appreciation of who God is and what he's really up to in the world and what's the right way to perceive the world, have come up across those roadblocks where God has stretched the boundaries of my understanding, and my response was a very strong, visceral, "No, no, no, I can't accept that. I can't go there. I can't believe that." And we've had to have the courage to push through those feelings and recognize what the actual truth is. Because those feelings, as powerful as they were not telling me the truth. Now, I have to say, sometimes those feelings are telling me the truth. And then the appropriate response is to recognize why those feelings are reflecting the truth, what's true about them, and then make a genuine, calculated commitment to reject what's false, reject what's evil. So they're not infallible, but they're not always wrong either. And we have to learn to respond to those feelings and understand what exactly they are telling us, where are they coming from, why are they there, and what are we going to do about it.
So I can really relate to that in two ways. One is, I have really, when things have come up for me that I don't want to believe, that might make me have to change directions in my life, or I might have to choose something I don't really want to choose, what I sometimes do is just deny that those feelings, deny my conscience, not want to look at it, not want to pay attention to it, kind of squelch it, so I can go on in my merry way and not have to change any direction. There's been other times in my life, usually when I'm slammed up against the wall and I have a bloody nose, that I look at the questions, the feelings that my conscience is talking to me about, and I evaluate if I should continue to go in that same direction or not. And I think that's true for most people. It's really tough when we're asked to make a different decision, like Peter was, to not just walk away from it. I remember going to a particular school, for example, and it was a school that I thought was really going to help me pursue God in my life. And this was when I was going to college a long time ago. And I remember having all the sense that this really wasn't a very good place for me. And I just didn't want to pay attention to that.
While you were there or before you went?
No, while I was there.
While you were there.
It probably happened before I went. In fact, yeah. Not probably, it did. There was some big signs that said this really wasn't a good place for me. And I wanted, quite honestly, to be with my boyfriend. And he was there, and I wanted to pursue him, and so I went there. And all the signals that came up for me were, you know, this is really not a good place for me. And I just ignored them over and over and over again. And finally, you know, when I started listening to the fact that it wasn't a good place was when my boyfriend and I broke up. And finally, my mind was let loose enough from having to pursue him till really looking at the situation that I was in. And man, it was like I turned on a dime. All of a sudden, the things that I had not allowed myself to really see or be uncomfortable with became really bright. And I had a very difficult time looking at the fact that I had stayed there all those years, that I had pursued a relationship, which I had, by the way, a lot of signs that wasn't a good thing for me either. And I just didn't want to look because it would have made me have to review my faith and have to possibly not be in relationship with that guy. And to me, that meant I would give up on marriage in my life because I felt like I was getting older. I was getting out of college. I really needed to have this solid relationship and it would have been gone. So there was a lot against. I just didn't want to pay attention to the messages that I was getting.
So it would be like Peter having felt that it would cost him too much to socially in his relationships with his contemporaries. It would have cost him too much to change the status quo. So ignore the vision, ignore the instruction of God, and just go with his. Well, in that case, though, he would have been going with his feelings, though, instead of
going
against. So that's where it's different from your example, because you were wanting to go against what your feelings were telling
right.
you. Okay.
Right. But so both of them would have represented courage. Peter did have courage. He went and did what he was supposed to do. I didn't have courage because I didn't do what I was supposed to. What I knew really were good decisions for me to make.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think I can look back and clearly know that. I just didn't want to pay attention to it at the time.
Mm-hmm.
So I really lacked courage. I wasn't willing to let it cost me anything. And I think that's what happens a lot in our lives. Instead of being willing to have the courage, as Peter did, to walk forward, we don't. And I think we don't a lot of the time because we ignore the signs that we're being given. And the signs are not very often like Peter. Peter had this vision from God and a voice from God, and that That just isn't normally our experience at all. Our experience is small callings inside our hearts, that is our conscience. Mm-hmm. They are often in the form of feelings. Like you said earlier, if they're pretty strong, we might even feel it physically. But I don't think it needs to even get that far feel it physically. But to, you know, have these little senses of something's up, and we need to pay attention to those. I have a concern, though, about that, Jack. I was mentioning this to you earlier, is that when these feelings come up, when our conscience has this little voice in our heads, we are told, both by the church, I think, and by the world, the non-Christian community, what you need to do is ignore that very often, especially in the non-Christian community, if they're questions of moral concern. You were saying that the only thing that we really need to be concerned about is that we are aware of and paying attention to diversity, and that we allow that in our lives. And if anything makes us not make diversity okay, if we don't allow your truth to be your truth, if we have any sense that truth is not relative, then we're kind of cast out.
In our modern culture.
In our modern culture.
Right.
Do you want to say any more about that before I go on?
No, go ahead.
And so if your truth is your truth, then in our culture, I'm not allowed to question it. I'm not allowed to have an opinion about it. I'm not allowed to put it up against truth with a capital T. And
in fact, you're not even allowed to feel like I'm bad in our culture.
Yeah, I'm bad if I even have these feelings that come up.
Right.
And so instead of me being able to really discern, well, is this right or is this wrong, I'm just supposed to throw out all my feelings and just go along with what everybody wants. And I'm good in our culture if I do that. And so what we do is we take our conscience and kind of smolder it.
Yeah, just smash it.
Yeah, or I just think about, you know, kind of these little flames that are trying to come up, and we just take a big bucket full of water and just douse it. Mm-hmm. And then what we do is we say that's loving. If I don't have any opinion about the moral decisions you're making, that you're being promiscuous, Jack's not being promiscuous, I'm just using that as an example, then I'm good because I'm not being judgmental.
Right.
Well, I think what we've really lost is we can make a judgment about things, a moral judgment, and decide what we're going to do with that. We can decide to be loving toward the person who's being promiscuous, or we can decide not to. Deciding not to be loving is a bad decision too. But it's just as wrong to say your promiscuity is okay as it is for me to be hurtful towards you who are promiscuous.
Yeah, that's good. That's right.
Both sides. Mm-hmm. But we douse it all and say it's loving to pretend as though nothing's wrong. And in doing so, we lose our conscience. We lose our heart. We lose a sense of what morality is. We lose a sense of who God is and what his righteousness is about and what holiness is about. We harden our conscience. We harden our souls. On the other side, in the Christian community, we say, well, what you should do is just be obedient. You should just forgive people. You should just love. You should just do what's right. And all of those things are right. But we forget how to do that. Truly loving somebody is not just closing our mind off to looking at a very small slice of life, but it's opening our minds up and understanding what's really going on in this situation. So let me give an example, or would you like to?
No, go ahead.
I'm on a roll, huh?
Yeah, you are.
Well, here comes my counseling background again. I kind of come up with these examples a lot. Let's take the person who's promiscuous again to look at this other side. What I might do as a Christian is say, I might have a lot of feelings about this person being promiscuous and, you know, really want to go and tell them, you know, this is wrong. You shouldn't do this. You need to be obedient. And I have a very strong feeling that I need to do that, that that's really important. So that's kind of my visceral response. You know, it's kind of like that thing on your computer that says, what do you want to do with this? I have that response. On the other hand, as a Christian, I might have this response that I better not say anything and just forgive them, leave it alone, not do anything, not think anything about it other than just to forgive them. Well, both of those responses aren't really looking at or uncovering what this visceral response might want me to look at. What I may need to do instead of, for example, hurting this person, judging this person, telling them to, you know, being judgmental toward this person in a hurtful way, what I might need to do is look at, again, what does the scripture say about someone who's promiscuous? What does it really mean for a person to be promiscuous? And how is that different than who I am, perhaps, in terms of my own sin? Instead of me then coming out as a person who's self-righteous toward this person, I might look at my own self, for example, and say, wait a minute, so I'm not promiscuous, but I have these other areas of weakness and failure in my own life. I can then take that with me, a different heart, a different understanding with me, and relate to this person on a really different level, kind of like Peter did. He recognized he wasn't different than the other person. I might, when I look at my huge reaction against promiscuity, what I might do is have to then look at some areas in my life. Why am I being so angry at this? Why is it that I can't let this go? Well, maybe what I need to do is remember that when I was growing up, my parents were promiscuous, and I remember walking in on one of them having an affair with somebody else, and that gripped me so much that instead of looking at that and dealing with that issue in my life, I bring it into the present and make you, the person that's promiscuous, the bad person, and I need to change you and judge you and hurt you, when the reality is, this is something that I need to work on from way back there.
So I think what you're saying, and it makes a lot of sense to me, is that another way to understand our responses is that they're very important pieces of information about me so that I can come to that greater clarity of understanding myself, to better self-knowledge. I mean, like Peter, for example, part of what he must have had to have gone through was to try to ask himself, why is it so hard for me to walk into the house of a Gentile when God has told me that that's what I'm supposed to do? Why is that so hard for me? And to be able to recognize that it comes out of his training, out of his background, out of his culture, where the culture has been right, where the culture has been wrong. He has to sort all that stuff out. And in part, he's coming to understand himself better, what has made Peter the Peter that exists right now.
And it turned him upside down in terms of his faith as somebody who might have to look at the promiscuity early in their life.
Right.
It would turn them upside down. Both of them would. And Jack, it isn't just towards self-knowledge. I'm sure that this is where you were going. But it's self-knowledge that leads me into a more godly life.
Right, yeah, exactly.
That self-knowledge helps me to love other people more. Again, what I keep coming back to in Peter's life, it helped him recognize that he wasn't any different than the Gentiles. And he truly humbled himself to that awareness. And that's why self-knowledge is really important. But if we up front turn off this visceral response, as you call it, our emotional response, our conscience, which I think in both the Christian and the non-Christian world, in different ways, we're told to do that. Just skip over that and douse it out. Then we never come to a place where we are learning to love ourselves, God, and other people better.
So the counterpart then to what you say happens sometimes in the Christian world would be, if Peter had simply here gone to Cornelius' house, but without really ever resolving in his own heart, in his own mind, I really am free to do this. I really am, and here's why, but was just doing it, he wouldn't have really grown as a person. He wouldn't really be the more mature, wiser Peter that we see him being.
He would have changed his behavior.
Right.
But he might have even had to get hard against the people that later persecuted him and just kind of be a person that just kind of say, well, I'm just trying to do what's right. Well, out of the depth of his heart, he came to believe something new.
Right.
He came to be something new.
Right.
And we can't become something new if we just change our standards, if we just change our behavior.
Our outward behavior. That's a good point. I think we're running out of time here. Just a disclaimer here. When we talk about the conscience here, we're not talking about something spooky, something that only Christians have, something that is a supernatural directive from God. Peter was getting that, but as you mentioned earlier, we don't typically get that sort of thing. What we're talking about here is God just working in what is a normal human phenomenon, I think. Non-Christians experience this, Christians experience this. What we do with this is going to be different if we're a child of God from a child of the devil. But these responses, these scruples, these hesitations, these feelings we get, it's just a normal part of being a human being, I think.
Many spiritual leaders promise to satisfy our spiritual yearning for peace and enlightenment. Even many Christians believe that one can be a super Christian and rise above moral and physical limitations. Mackenzie Study Center staff member Larry Barber objects to these claims in his News and Views article, Real Spirituality. By looking at 1 Corinthians and Romans, Larry shows how the Apostle Paul saw spirituality. That is, it's a process whereby the Spirit of God reveals to us the truth about God, ourselves, and the world. It is not a state of consciously feeling closer to God. It is the pursuit of righteousness in a fallen world with other fallen people like ourselves. Please call Mackenzie at 541-485-4801 for your free News and Views article, Real Spirituality.
Christine, for a number of months now, we've been trying to let our listeners know where we stand financially and asking them to contribute as they can. We've got lots of feedback that the program has been helpful to people in a number of different ways. But do you know how we stand financially right now?
The small contributions have kind of trickled in. And in terms of larger contributions, I think we've gotten two. We actually got two $8,000 contributions. And the second $8,000 contribution, the people ask that we match the funds. So they will give up to $8,000 dependent on how much is given up to that amount. So it's a possible $16,000 contribution, which is pretty significant. And it's very encouraging.
So any of the listeners out there who are willing to make a contribution to match the funds, they could support us to the tune of another $8,000 then.
Right.
Great.
Which is pretty exciting.
Yeah.
So thank you for contributing, and we again encourage you to consider contributing if this program has been beneficial to you.
You have been listening to Christianity at Work, a radio ministry of Mackenzie Study Center. If you would like a free copy of this program, or would like to know more about Mackenzie Study Center or Gutenberg College, you may call us at area code 541-485-4801. You can write to us at 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. And we're also on the Internet. Look for us under Mackenzie Study Center or Gutenberg College. Tapes can be purchased with check or Visa. If you didn't have time to write all that down, I'll repeat it again in just a moment. The Mackenzie staff has worked for years studying the Bible, understanding the world we live in, and pursuing what it means to be a Christian. They desire that their ministry may be valuable to others, but they also know that their efforts are in deep need of God's mercy. You can join the Mackenzie staff in their ministry through their classes, seminars, tapes, and papers. The Mackenzie Study Center is a nonprofit ministry entirely funded by the generous contributions of people who believe in its goals and have benefited from its ministry. If you would like to make a gift to Mackenzie, it will be entirely tax deductible. Just mail your check to Mackenzie Study Center, 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. If you would like to request a free taped copy of today's program, the telephone number is 541-485-4801. Now, on behalf of Dr. Jack Crabtree, Christine Barber, and the other staff of Mackenzie Study Center, thank you for listening.